We are in room 1200 of the Minnesota Senate building, and I'm very glad to be here tonight. Very happy to be able to work on this task force. I think it's a really important issue or a really important area for us to work on. Great work was started last session in the House, and I'm really pleased that we're able to continue that with a task force with some recommendations coming out before next session. I think we're all familiar with how important it is for families to have access to quality child care and how important it is for kids to have access to quality, stable, and healthy environments and for their growth and development and for parents to know that their children are safe and secure in their environments. It's also really important that we're supporting our providers in Minnesota and helping them to be able to provide the best possible care to children in their care. And I think that, you know, we have some ways that we could be doing a better job with that, and that's something we'll be talking about in the task force. Also, just some information. Minnesota has lost over 3,000 in-home child care providers over the last decade. We have many places in Minnesota, and especially in greater Minnesota, where there are shortages of available child care, and that affects not only families. Parents can't if they can't find a place, a safe place for their child to be. It also affects our greater Minnesota communities. Businesses may have jobs that they need to fill and are just not able to fill because families can't find a place for their children. And so that's definitely something that we want to discuss in the task force. The task force comes out of work done in the House last session, 2016 session, the House Select Committee on Child Care, which Representative Franson led. And they started by gathering information about concerns and issues facing child care providers and families, and also began much-needed discussions between providers, parents, business leaders, state agencies, and legislators so that we can all understand what the issues are and find ways to better address the needs and concerns of providers and families. And how can we do a better job of attracting more people to the field of child care to address shortage situations in our state? So tonight we'll begin our conversation. We have a fairly limited time frame. We have the opportunity to have meetings until the end of the year, and then a report is due in January to the legislature, due January 15th. So first I'd just like to have people introduce themselves. We had a couple members who could not be here tonight, but we have several members who are here, so I'd like if you could introduce yourself and where you're from, where you represent. I am Melissa Halverson-Wickland. I represent Bloomington and Richfield in the State Senate. And Representative Franson, if you have any comments and would like to begin.
Yes, Representative Mary Franson. I represent District EP, which is the northeastern part of Douglas County and the eastern half of Otter Tail County. I also was the chair on the Select Committee on Affordable Child Care that last session where we traveled. We traveled to see eight areas of the state. I believe we had eight different meetings. I'm also a former licensed child care provider.
Oh, I better start over. So is it recording? Was it recording? Yeah.
Well, only what could be heard, so it's okay. Probably good to
I'll just start over for the record. Representative Mary Franson, I represent District 8B, which is the northeastern part of Douglas County in the eastern half of Otter Tail County. Also the chair of the Select Committee on Affordable Child Care. We toured around the state. We did about eight different meetings from a rural down to we just finished up a meeting in North Minneapolis last month. And I'm also a former licensed child care provider, so I bring my expertise of almost 5 years into the legislature. And what Senator Wicklund has said about the loss of providers, it is very real all over the state. And so we want to put together ideas of how we can make this business prosper more without overburdening our child care providers. And I think we heard some very eye-opening testimony when we traveled the state, a lot of dealing with frustration with licensing. Licensors within counties may not be on the same page interpreting statutes. Counties may not one county may not interpret the statute the same way a neighboring county or another county may. Child care providers being written up in one county for such an issue, and then in the other county it is just fine. So interpretation of statute has been absolutely huge. Another thing is that we heard is that the retaliation from providers feel is very real, from licensors, from DHS, simply asking a question about their job, if this is kosher, if this is not kosher, may land them with basically a red mark on their door saying, come visit me, I think I'm doing something wrong, and that licensor showing up and writing them up for simply basically asking a question to make sure that they are running their business appropriately. So it is very important that we address these issues in this task force and come up with real workable solutions so that we can grow the child care provider field. Parents want to work, and right now to find child care, licensed child care, is extremely hard all over the state.
Representative Purcell, if you, and I should have mentioned, when you do speak, you do need to flip that switch up to the on position. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm John Purcell, State Representative, District 5A, Bemidji, Leech Lake Indian Reservation, my district, north central Minnesota. I'm not going to cover too much that has been said, or I'll try not to, but we certainly know there's issues to be addressed. I was on the task force, and we traveled in areas of the state of Minnesota. I personally was at 5 different meetings, if memory serves, and we heard about issues and folks that want to be child care providers but can't because the rules and regs or the CCAP reimbursement's too low. So there has to be some economic feasibility brought to the forefront across the state of Minnesota and the quality of child care. And I think it was somewhat amazingly, although I human beings are human beings no matter where you find them in Minnesota, I would offer to you. And we heard just about the same issues at every meeting that I was at. I brought a list of my notes from one meeting. You could lay it up against other people's notes from other meetings, and it's the same issue. So we know we've got a statewide task ahead of us here, and that's a fitting way to start us out here. And I wanted to thank Representative Franzen for chairing that task force, because we found out some good information, and we can bring that over here and share with our Senate colleagues, and looking forward to working with y'all.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Johnson.
And I should be able to remember that. I'm Senator Alice Johnson, represent District 37 in Anoka County, represent Blaine, Coon Rapids, and Spring Lake Park. Happy to be here.
And I think it's me. I'm State Senator Dave Sendrum from Rochester, representing the north, if you will, half of Rochester, northern Olmsted County, the cities of Orinoco, Byron, Cass and Dodd Center, Manorville. And I met with my child care providers, at least a representative group of them, before coming here. I've got a long list of issues and concerns that they have, and over the coming meetings, we'll probably get into all of them, and some of them have already been, reflected. This is a much larger problem than maybe I even realized before I got into this, but it's an absolutely critical problem to our state. It's certainly terribly important from the standpoint of the personal financial security of individual families who have a need to certainly work. And if you think in a larger scale, it's a great big deal from the standpoint of the economic prosperity of our state. Our state depends on working families, and working families can't work without child care. And so it's a critical subject, and I appreciate being a part of this.
Well, thank you. And I'll just mention there are members who could not be here tonight. Carla Nelson is also a member of the task force, and she's from Rochester area as well. Representative Peggy Flanagan from the House is also a member, and Representative Tony Albright. And they were hoping to be here, but were unable to be at this meeting, and look forward to having their input on the future meetings. So just a couple other housekeeping items. I did want to let people know that there is a web page for this task force on the LCC website. So it's lcc.leg.mn/TFCC for Task Force on Child Care. And if you look on that website, there's a list of members. There will be the meeting dates posted, materials posted, and agendas. And then there's also a way to sign up for email notifications of meetings coming up. So I hope that you'll go in and subscribe if you are interested in attending future meetings, and that you'll sign up, and then you'll get notified of all of the notices that are sent out from this website. So first, on the agenda, I had to review the task force charge just briefly. You have in your packets the information from statute that covers the legislative task force, the creation and duties, and just to highlight that we're here to review the loss of child care providers in the state, you know, assess affordability issues for providers and parents, and identify areas that need to be addressed by the legislature. That's sort of high level. And then in the duties section, there are 11 duties called out, and it says task force may. So we may not be able to cover each of them in depth, but we definitely want to make sure that we cover all of the duties that people have, you know, keen interest in covering, and we have included them all in the work plan so that we're able to track them going forward. And then recommendations that need to come out of this task force, there needs to be a report issued, and that needs to be to the legislative committees and the governor by January 15th of 2017. And it states that it must contain summary information obtained during the task force meetings and recommendations for additional legislative changes and procedures affecting access to affordable child care. So we'll be working on that as we go through the meetings, and have a meeting in December to review report contents, hopefully, and then get the sign off from all the members on the report before we publish that in January. And also, I'm remiss to mention we have staff members here tonight. My assistant, Nathan Coulter, will be supporting us, and then Laura Larson from Representative Franson's office. And they will be working on the reporting and keeping up with the meetings together as we go forward. So I really appreciate their time. We also have assistance from Senate Counsel and House Research. And so we will have additional members attend meetings as necessary. And are there any questions about the task force charge? Okay. And then next on the agenda, I had an overview of the Select Committee on Affordable Child Care. And I thought if Representative Franson and Representative Purcell, if there's any other specific items that you'd like to have us all be grounded in from your meetings last session, we do have a handout from the Department of Human Services that has at the title or at the top it says licensing lessons learned from the 2016 Select Committee. So I, you know, if you would like to cover both of you, you know, anything that you'd like to cover about the Select Committee, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Senator Wicklund. So what we did get signed into law was this task force so that we could work with child care providers and parents to develop reforms for the next legislative session, including ways to streamline burdensome paperwork, regulations, create uniformity and consistency in the application of child care laws, and address costs related to running a child care business and having children in care. The next item signed into law was child care business startup community grants. Greater Minnesota communities could collaborate to develop unique solution plans to invest in child care business startups so that families can have access to the care they desperately need. $500,000 to be administered by DEED. And currently, DEED is requesting information to help draft the grant applications. And then the third item that was passed into law was a child care business startup manual. So many people do not exactly enter the child care field because there isn't a central, easily accessible manual to help understand the regulations and other processes. So we wanted to work to minimize the seemingly overwhelming startup process by creating a simple how-to guide on starting a child care business in multiple innovative capacities, and that is also administered through DEED. Now, some of the items that we got from the listening sessions that we offered that did not get passed was to have a Department of Human Services provider advocate. What we wanted is to have an advocate to act as a liaison using existing appropriations for a full-time employee. And we wanted that advocate to be required to be responsive to the needs and requests of providers, because providers were afraid and worried to go exactly to DHS or to their licensor. So we wanted a neutral party to help bridge those two parties together. That did not get funded or passed or signed into law. We also wanted an online portal that could be used by child care providers and prospective providers that would provide a single point of access for statutes and rules relevant to child care. Many of the concerns that we had gotten from providers or from people wanting to start up the business is that accessing the information on the DHS website is kind of cumbersome, and trying to find the information is very difficult. A big thing was on notification of correction orders. Imagine a licensor coming to your place of business. The visit seems to have gone extremely well, and 3 weeks later you go to your mail and you get written up with a correction order on something that you had no idea was not in compliance with the law that the licensor had interpreted. So for 3 weeks, that licensor may have been operating with something that was not supposed to be operating in that way. So what we wanted to do was have county licensors to be required to notify family child care providers in writing prior to leaving the provider's home if there is a potential violation. This was to curtail any surprise correction orders that child care providers receive by mail following the inspection. We also wanted licensor training and uniformity to increase consistency in the application of child care programs. Regulations, 8 hours of pre-service training would be required of every county licensor, the party responsible for regulation of family child care providers in Minnesota. Also included would have been a requirement for DHS to increase oversight of licensors, including biennial reviews of their performance, an annual notice to county licensors and county staff on new laws relating to family and group child care enacted in the past year would also be required. That did not pass. And then, of course, we wanted to repeal the child care unionization authority. It was in a couple of bills that did not pass. And that is that. Representative Purcell.
Uh, I'm not going to add a whole lot, Madam Chair, but one thing that we certainly heard about, I believe, everywhere universally was from providers, was they needed adequate funding and from CCAP in order to make ends meet, and that was something that's been discussed, and we weren't able to get there in the last session, but it's certainly something that we can address in a straightforward fashion. The one other item that was nuance to me, but it may not be. It certainly isn't to folks that are seeking child care. But when somebody moves from one county to the next, they can lose their CCAP. And I think if this was a state-administered program, and we all understand how local control and local government works in counties and all of that, but that puts a real bind on somebody then if they get a job in a different place and one county over, and then all of a sudden they don't have child care anymore. So this just things like that, our administration of our current system can be improved. That's likely the case with almost everything we do in life, but that's what I heard a lot of. Thank you.
Do others, senators, do you have any questions about any of those? Are you familiar? Senator Senjum.
Madam Chair, is there a summary of your comments anywhere that isn't writing? I mean, I was absorbing them as you were listening, but I'm not going to absorb them and retain them very long. I think they're important.
Yeah, I think would that be something that we could put together?
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Senjum, that is something that we can put together and give to you and Senator Johnson. Right. Okay.
And I believe a lot of the duties, some of them seem like specific items that might have come out of your conversations as well. So that hopefully will help us make sure we cover the different concern areas. Okay. And if you don't have any other, comments right now, we could have our presentation. Ann McCulley is here from Child Care Aware, Minnesota. And that may also reinforce some of the things what were heard in the committee or in the meetings you had across the state. I think probably will be reinforced by your presentation as well. And members, we do have a copy of the presentation slides in your or at your position. So thank you for coming tonight, and go ahead and proceed.
Thank you very much, and thank you, members, for taking time. I am excited, as you might imagine, to hear you take up this topic. It is near and dear to my heart and to my system's heart. Two other handouts that I had staff make sure you have that are out for the public are an updated version of state child care facts, so the more current numbers around what we have in terms of centers and family child care and what the capacity looks like, and some updated figures on cost on the back. And then what I've provided is an executive summary of the cost of care report. The full report is quite lengthy, but I'll be pulling aspects out of it, but you at least have the executive summary, and I'm following basically the format of that report. By way of introduction, my name is Ann McCulley, and I am Executive Director of Child Care Aware of Minnesota, formerly known as Child Care Resource and Referral. So if you know that term, we're still here. We just have a new name. To introduce how we fit into the picture, this was actually a request that came to me through our national office, because the report we're going to be looking at is actually done by the Child Care Aware of America organization, of which we are a member, but it is not a governance relationship. So Child Care Aware of Minnesota primarily exists to, our core work is funded by the Department of Human Services, and if you think of it as funding that comes to the state through the Child Care Development and Block Grant, the funding that is primarily earmarked to work on quality and quality improvement, that is by and large what we do as a system. So what's on this slide is our mission statement, What that translates to is we help parents find early care and education in their community and understand what those options look like. We do a lot of professional development and other supports to child care providers, so we are considered the primary deliverer of training for child care providers through the state. We do work with public policy at the local and state level in terms of being at tables and bringing data forward. And then we also, most recently and most probably notably, have been the on-the-ground implementation arm for Parent Aware, which is the quality rating and improvement system. So just a bit about this report, and really you've touched on so many of the issues already, and I feel like I'm preaching to the choir, so I'll just say that the report is not meant, this is the ninth year we've done the report, and I always have to clarify that it is not a report meant to vilify childcare costs and childcare providers. It really is a report that tries to look at the context and the cost and also think about what are we going to do to help families, over 11 million children in childcare, be able to afford and access childcare. These are just some of the points that the report brings to light. It talks about the importance of childcare as a workforce support, which a few of you have mentioned. It talks a little bit about the changing demographics and the impact of childcare on our community as those continue to change. It ranks states, and this is where you'll hear me touch on this many times. What gets confusing in the media is that it ranks states by cost, but specifically cost of center-based care. And you'll hear in a few minutes why that's a bit complex for us here in Minnesota. But because of the way that the nation tends to be a little more common in the way it thinks of child care centers versus family child care, which I will elaborate on, they have chosen to rank it based on center-based only. And then, of course, looking at the cost of childcare in relation to family income. Those are the main tenets of the report. So more specifically, there's information, again, about licensed childcare. And let me just step back and say for a minute, in this whole world of early care and education, there's a lot of pieces that sort of get put into that pie. We sometimes talk about unlicensed care. We talk about family, friend, and neighbor care. We even talk about pre-K. What the report tends to track and is tracking is licensed family childcare, so the in-home providers you were talking about, and licensed childcare centers, and specifically those that charge. So you in Minnesota might have a Head Start program that is also a licensed program, but they aren't charging parents. So we're really homing in on the programs that have costs, that have a charge for families. We also, again, talk about ranking just based on center-based care, but the report does have some data on what licensed family child care looks like around the country. Maybe this is a good place just to say the reason that is so difficult. You know, we call this a system, and we call it a national system, and it's such a mix of, I often say, apples to kumquats. What we call licensing, when it starts, how many children it includes, how it's regulated looks different, so different from state to state, that it's very difficult to do a national study that pulls data together that's robust. So that's the challenge we face. This is the slide I feel pleased to say that I feel like I don't have to spend a lot of time on after the last few years at the legislature. I started in this work about 2002, 2003, which is when the first work of the Federal Reserve was coming out, and we spent a lot of time on this. And I think I've said to many people, it feels like we've crossed into not should we invest in child care and early education, but how should we invest, which is a huge accomplishment. So I don't spend a lot of time except to remind us that indeed it does help create strong families, strong communities, and healthier children. The piece, though, that the report also gets into that, interestingly, I think was more the focus when I first started in the field and has sort of gone away and come back, is this more specific issue about how does it impact the economy, the personal economy, the global economy, the business economy, and what do we do in particular for our lowest income families? So these are just a few statistics. On the right, you'll see the national picture. To the extent I could find data, I will give you the state picture on the left. So nationally, the figure is 65% of parents' work schedule are affected by childcare challenges, so 7.5 times on average over a month. Here in Minnesota, the most recent data we have is from the 2009 household survey that asked many questions of parents about the impact of childcare, finding it, keeping it, it impacting their work, but this particular was the closest to that statistic. 35% of families said they lost work time or income due to some kind of challenge with childcare, and that wasn't including a sick child. So it might be that the arrangement fell through. We have a lot of families who use multiple settings and multiple settings over time. Something happened with transportation. Could have been any number of things, but you've got over a third of families in that particular survey saying something happened and it affected their ability to work. And so when we wrap that all up into a price point, we've got over $4.4 billion annually that is costing our economy due to employee absenteeism as a result of these child care breakdowns. So it is a huge economic issue. The final piece is the report does spend some time on other family-friendly policies, and I realize that's not the goal of this particular committee, but I just want to say that sometimes because we, you know, talk a lot about child care, obviously we understand that there are other ways to reduce costs, to support families. These are just some of the other examples of policies that I know certainly have been in discussion here and nationally. We throw in a shameless plug for resource and referral because, frankly, from our perspective, it doesn't do a lot of good to have child care out there if families don't know what it is and how to access it, and we do consider that part of the picture. So this is more to the meat of what you've been asking about, and unfortunately, we don't have a current report. The most recent report I was aware of and did some checking that is statewide that is specific to the costs in Minnesota was actually done back in 2005, and I was actually part of the advisory to that report too, which makes me feel kind of old. But that report grew out of some changes to the Child Care Assistance Program, and the title of it and the sort of focus of it was cost containment. But as a part of that, there was some digging into, well, what does it cost a center and a family child care to operate? As I say, I don't have current data, but I would say that the things on this slide and are just about the same order are still the main drivers. And by and large, by far, it is staffing that is driving the cost of child care. 80%, up to 80%, I think it was about 62% when we did the study back in 2005. But it's sort of that simple math, and this is primarily, of course, for child care centers. If you have, and it's on average about 60 kids, just like we talk about in K-12, we want the smallest possible group size or class size. It's very important to have small group sizes and small ratios. You don't want five babies with one caregiver. You want three or four. So when you start doing the, I was telling somebody earlier, I wish I'd studied logarithms, but when you start doing the math, basically it comes down to, that's what the driver is. It is staff. Unfortunately, it is not staff compensation, which is a whole topic for another meeting, but it is definitely the cost of just hiring and maintaining staff and the costs that go with that. But right behind that, about 20% or so, again, based on an older study, was facilities. So we need space. We need adequate space. Providers need to have heat and lights and all the things that go with that space. We want kids warm and taken care of and having enough space to grow and learn. Food is a huge piece of it. It's not a huge driver percentage-wise, but if you think about snacks and breakfast and lunch, we have a family child care provider on my board, and she did a presentation on a typical day, and we were all, I think, blown away by how much of it involved food. Getting ready, serving, and cleaning up food. So food becomes a big part of the driver. And then program costs. We want children to have adequate toys and materials, and we want providers to have curriculum. Professional development and training is absolutely a piece, but it's price-wise, cost-wise, at least for centers, is not a huge driver. It's something that has been increasing, so maybe if we redid these numbers, it would look bigger, but at the point this was done in 2005, it was less than 1% of the cost. And then I wanted to just throw this on there. The other one to think about, and this will become clear later, is lost revenue. We still have providers who are not getting reimbursed at the rate they need to and should, and they're eating that cost. So, and there are sometimes parents that can't pay, and so lost revenue, albeit a very small piece, is in the mix too. So you add all of that together, that's what's driving the cost. This is the part that shocks people, especially those of you who either never went through trying to find childcare or haven't been in this arena for a very long time. Certainly we hear it for when our referral counselors deal with new parents, is when people hold up the cost of what childcare will be against some of these other costs of a typical family, it can be pretty shocking. This is, again, though, looking specifically now at center-based care, but this is very hard to read on the slide, and I apologize. I do have this available as a graphic if anybody wants it. But generally speaking, for housing, the cost of childcare for two children is higher than it is for housing in 24 states. For college tuition, I believe it's 28 states. A cost of a child, an infant in a center, is higher than college tuition at a public college, tuition and fees. For transportation, basically throughout the country, the cost of child care in a center is going to be more than your transportation costs. And then finally, food as well. Back to a single infant in a center is going to cost more than your food budget. And this is how this looks here in the Midwest, so bringing it a little closer to home. Pretty much what I just told you, this is looking at, and the report does often use this rubric of one infant and 1 4-year-old, sort of a typical married family with two kids is sort of the model. And if that were the case here in the Midwest, your childcare costs would run you $17,000, And you can see housing isn't far behind, but all the way down to healthcare being more like 4,000. So I think for most people who haven't spent time in this field, this is always a big surprise. This is just another way to illustrate the other way we tend to think about what makes for affordable childcare is we have used for a long time the figure of 10%. If 10% of less of your budget is going for childcare, by and large, that's considered affordable. So what this map tries to do is show you around the country, and again, this is center-based care for an infant as the measure, which is, of course, the most expensive. But if you look at the deepest, darkest color there, which includes us, that's states where we're over 12% of income. The percentage of income in the sort of next lightest shade is 10 to 12%. So only when we get to those states that are red are we getting to the place where we want to see ideally, which is below 10%. So if you're, again, a married couple, you have an infant, you have that infant in center-based care, that's the spread of where you might be expecting in terms of your percentage of income. This is the slide that catches everyone's attention, but I'm going to immediately get into some caveats. And this is the one that often gets misconstrued. If we look just at center-based care, however, for an infant in Minnesota, we rank as least affordable, highest cost. We are the fifth least affordable or fifth highest cost for four-year-olds in center-based care. This is, again, looking just at median income of a married couple. And so you can see the figures there, the median income for our state, $94,400. The average annual center-based infant care cost is $14,000. Average center-based four-year-old care, $11,000. Question?
I'm just going to break in and say, if people do have questions while you're speaking, is it okay if we...
Absolutely. Sorry. I'm sorry, Senator.
Okay. Go ahead, Representative Franson. Oh, I'm sorry.
You're going to catch on quickly. I'm learning. So this is a question everybody in the audience knows, but a center-based care is distinguished from what other kind of care?
Senator, Senator Senchum, yes. Madam Chair, center-based care would be licensed child care centers. So it's right, licensed under the Department of Human Services Rule 3. There is licensed family child care, which is what we call Rule 2.
Thank you.
Representative Franson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. McCulley, could we go back to the slide with the breakdown of the average cost for the center-based infant care? It was this, yep, that slide.
This slide? Here?
Yep.
Okay.
So one of the things that I and my staff had tried to figure out is what is the difference between South and North Dakota in Minnesota?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have the answer for that?
Madam Chair, Representative Franson, broadly or just for child care? I think, can I move forward a little bit? Because I do think we're going to talk a little bit about that in terms of the cost of centers. Is that...
Sure, but eventually we would like to know the difference between with licensed family child care as well.
Madam Chair, Representative Franson, let's see if we get to it and you can ask me again when we're a little further. Is that okay?
Representative Purcell?
I just want to
catch you before you move on and we can come back to this, but I'm quite taken by that second bullet point. I'm sure that's factual for some places in Minnesota, not my district. And so I want to come back to this, how we're using the numbers here.
Certainly. And Madam Chair, Representative Purcell, there will be some, I'm going to show you that in just a minute, how your district differs, maybe not yours specifically, but we've had a really wide range.
For the audience, if you didn't see that, that bullet point was that's the median income,
right.
$94,000. That's, I don't know, maybe my district can make it $94,000.
Right.
So.
Okay. And Chairman, okay. So this is this, and this we will get a little bit into a couple of different things, I think, Representative Franson, that will answer part of your question. Part of what drives Minnesota looks very different than any other, just about any other state, and this bar chart starts to get at it, is that we have a tremendous number of licensed family child care providers. From my looking at all of the fact sheets, so this same fact sheet that you see from Minnesota, our national office does prepare this for every other state. And not only do we have, again, with the caveat that what is a licensed family child care provider in other states could look very different, so their reporting could be much lower, but to the extent they are reported, we have the third highest number, even with the numbers we've lost, the third highest number of licensed family child care providers that I could find after just California and New York. tremendously large number of family child care versus a tremendously small number of centers. The other thing that is interesting about this is if you do the math and add those together, that's about 85% of our licensed market is family child care, and about 15 then would be centers. Most of the country, the average is about 60% is centers. I'm sorry, 60% is licensed family child care. So we have this huge gap, and I could not find another state except potentially Kansas that had about 80% family child care. So we have a huge number of family child care, very small number of centers. The other thing, and the other, by the way, the other programs here, just to give you some comparison, those would be our typical school-based pre-K, our free programs, most of them, many of them, our Head Start programs and our school-age care programs. So, you know, by and large, those two first bar charts outnumber all of those together. This is the other context I wanted to touch on, and again, this might get at some of your question, Representative Franson. The other thing that drives that center-based cost, not only is it a very small market compared to most other states, I would say including North Dakota, but most of those centers are based in the highest-priced metro areas, so the Twin Cities Metro and Olmsted County, and I'll show you a map in a minute of how those costs work. So you've got this sort of double whammy. You have a small market, you have them primarily in the highest-cost areas, and that, we think, at least partially is driving why that number looks so large. This slide actually might help, to your point, and illustrate it better. This is just giving you that sense of the scope. So the first line across is infant in a child care center. If you are in our low, quote-unquote, lowest-priced county, so the state has, a few years ago, instead of going county by county, has clustered the costs into four clusters. So our lowest-priced counties, or our lowest-priced cluster, which you'll see on the map, you would be paying, as you see, about $6,700 for an infant. But if you are in the Twin Cities Metro or Olmsted County, you could be paying $16,900. That's just the difference in the cost between rural and metro. You even see it a little bit on the next line, which is an infant in family child care. Again, the gap isn't as wide, but you would be paying less in our rural counties, more in our metro counties. So a lot of this is driven by the place and the setting, and that does kind of paint a better picture, I think, than trying to put it all into a statewide average. And here's that map, and I apologize to the members that the black and white, and I think it's black and white in your handouts, but we can get you color. Left is family child care, the right is center. So again, that very lowest cost you saw, the darkest green areas would be looking to pay that. The highest cost you saw would be in the bright red areas. So to some extent, that helps us explain the ranking. What I usually say at this point is, at some point, though, we try not to get hung up on the ranking itself, but really at the end of the day, childcare is expensive. Whether we're ranked first or 41st, it's an expensive proposition, and there isn't a lot of fat to cut when it comes to the childcare programs themselves, and we certainly know that we can't price parents any higher than we have.
Senator Johnson.
Question on this, the yearly costs ranging widely. Explain to me why the infant disparity is so great, much more than the family, the infant with the family child care.
And Madam Chair and Senator Johnson, I think we're back to the point I was making earlier about staff. When we're dealing with infants in centers, we need multiple staff. Minnesota has tended to go beyond what some states have in terms of having very small group sizes and small ratios of staff to infants. So when you're in a center, you might need multiple staff. If you want to keep that ratio to 3 infants to 1 adult, you need multiple adults. Centers tend to be serving up to 60 kids or even more. So there's more children. Family child care usually has 7 to 9, can be as many as 14 if it's a group family child care home, but the data I just recently pulled was the average is 9. Actually, the desired average is 7. So it's a much smaller group of children. So the costs are lower. Does that make sense? Shall I go on?
Any other questions? Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. And I'm happy to go back at any point. I really just have a few more slides. This is just the issue that we, of course, this is near and dear to our heart, too, which is to talk just a few minutes about how does all of this impact, particularly impact our lowest income families. When we talk about access, this is just a slide talking about the poverty level, where we're at in Minnesota. This was, I tried to match this to the year the data was pulled in the cost reports. That was 2014. So in 2014, the poverty level was $19,790 for a family of three. If that family of three had no other supports, they would have been spending 71% of their income on infant care in a center and 39% of their income in family child care home. So we're not to where we want to be again, keeping that 10% figure in mind. On the right, you can see that across the country, it ranges from anywhere from 24% all the way up to 85% in Massachusetts. 24 is Mississippi. So when we're dealing with particularly families at the poverty level, that said, if they're accessible, we do have programs primarily for families at poverty. This is the slide I think that concerns us even more, and that's when we get to 200% of poverty. By this time, 39,580, you're starting to see families edge out of when they're going to be eligible for basic sliding fee. They're already probably ineligible for free and reduced lunch. So most of the supports that we have built for families who are considered low income have kind of disappeared at this point, and yet you're still seeing a family having to spend 36% of their income. Again, if we've got this infant, married couple with an infant, they'd have to spend 36% in a center, and again, about 20% of their funding in a home. So even though our costs are lower in family child care, we're still outside that range if a family's at 200% of the poverty level of making it accessible to them. Just a couple words about that basic sliding fee. This is probably not a surprise slide to you, certainly the discussions over the years, but this is just the latest available through December. We continue to have a challenge with having, even if someone is eligible economically, the waiting list across the state. We're standing right now at, as of December at 6,500. We haven't really moved that needle, and plain and simple, we would need to make investments in that in order to move that needle. This is, in some ways, my favorite slide, but also the one that also gets misinterpreted a lot. Sometimes people think this is talking about what percentage of providers' costs are covered by child care assistance. But what this really is trying to illustrate is, and I always use a visual, so I'm a family. This piece of paper represents my child care assistance money. If you look back up in 2004, and actually if we had the graph going back further, it would climb much higher, closer to that 75% is what the goal would be. Ideally, I would be able to take my amount of money and I could turn around in my community or statewide and what I had in my hand would cover the complete cost of 75% of the programs, meaning that I would have access to about 75% of the 100% of programs in my community. We have dropped from where we started here was 68% down to, if you notice in 2014, basically, I'm a family, here's my child care assistance money, I want to choose a program. Most likely, I will only be able, and this is statewide, but it doesn't look a whole lot different, metro and rural, I would only be able to find about 30% of the centers where I would go in, or 29% of the family child care programs where I would go in and say, here's my child care assistance money, it would cover all of their cost. So that gap between that 29%, or if I try to go to one of those programs where this won't cover the cost, their choices are to eat that cost, which happens, to scholarship that cost either with the new early learning scholarships if I'm able to get that or through some kind of private scholarship fund or to charge me, which I'm already low income, I'm probably not going to be able to pay that. So we've got a real dilemma on our hands in that we are not able to reimburse close enough to what providers really need, and that is also causing them to have difficulty making the funding they need. Mm-hmm. Make sense?
Right.
So it's a little confusing. Two more slides and I'm done. Potential solutions. Forgive me for offering solutions, but it's part of the report. The national report talks about these solutions. Then I'll just talk a little bit about what they might look like or do look like in Minnesota. I mean, some of the obvious ones are, frankly, as I said earlier, I think our position is we can't put any more on parents and we really can't find much more to trim. It really needs increased investment, public and private investment, to make it work. It's such a critically important, child care is such a critically important piece of our economy that we need to be investing in it. And so more funding for state and federal investment, expanding the supply. I'm so excited that you're talking about this need. We know that we have lost a lot of the supply for a variety of different reasons, but we need to incentivize more people to get into the field and to stay in the field. Layering funding, the ability to blend all these miraculous funding streams, but we can't always make them work together. We need to look for ways to do that. We've had great luck in Minnesota involving the business community, but continuing to do that, making sure we keep them in the fold and involved. And then finally, of course, the tax system, particularly for our middle-income families. And then this is just my attempt to put that into Minnesota speak. So investing in the basic sliding fee to help work with that waiting list and those reimbursement rates in terms of just even just having more families access it. The one thing we have done here in Minnesota the last few years is if a childcare program has been rated through Parent Aware and has a 3 or 4 star rating, they can get a higher reimbursement than what you saw on that slide. So actually, we are starting for some programs, if they're able to bring enough children in and have a high enough star rating, they can start to close that gap. That's a positive step in the right direction, I think. Mixed delivery, this whole discussion about pre-K, happy to talk much longer about that. That's a whole discussion as well. But I think we feel strongly that if we don't find a way for childcare, particularly family childcare, to be somewhere in that picture, based on what you saw on the earlier slide, if every 4-year-old in a family childcare program right now were out of that program and in only a school setting, we would have a real challenge keeping those programs afloat from the economic standpoint. Early Head Start Child Care Partnerships are a fantastic new opportunity. They're bringing sort of the best of both worlds, funding from the federal level, bringing the Head Start quality and the Head Start elements into child care programs. Child care has the setting, has kids maybe that are already comfortable. They bring that. Head Start brings the wraparound services. It's been a new and growing area that I think shows some really good lessons learned. And then finally, a couple things, as I already talked about, tax credits and really getting, and I know my colleague Heidi Hagel-Braid is here from First Children's Finance. They've been doing a lot of work on this last bullet point, and the deed grants that you mentioned speak to this as well, which is to really look to local communities and businesses to invest in capacity building for child care. That is the end of my presentation. Happy to take questions.
Okay. Thank you very much. Members, do you have any questions, additional questions? I have one question about that, the Early Head Start Child Care Partnerships. Mm-hmm. How are those facilitated, and I guess what agencies are involved in making those happen?
Madam Chair and members, and I know enough to be dangerous, but others could speak to it in the future in more detail. I believe we have 6 grantees in Minnesota from the first round. I may be slightly off. It was a competitive process whereby Head Start agencies or other agencies, so happened in Minnesota, the people that bid on it tended to be already doing Head Start, had an opportunity to receive funding from the federal government. There's a lot of specifics that go with it. Again, it's specifically focused on early Head Start, which is infants and into toddlers and kind of crossing into that 3-year-old range. And the whole goal of it was to try to do it in a way that you're either working with a child care center or a family child care setting. So you're, again, bringing the best of both worlds. What's nice about it is those family child care centers tend to get reimbursed then at a higher level because Head Start can pay more. They have to reach a higher quality level and meet all the regulations of Head Start, which do tend to be, you know, somewhat more rigorous in some cases. But they also get the benefit of the, as I mentioned, the wraparound care, the mental health, and some of the other healthcare-related aspects of Head Start. As I understand, there's another round of grants coming available, and we may see other entities in the state deciding to take this on. So I like it simply, as I say, because I think it's a nice way to both layer funding and bring the best of both worlds together, and we may be able to look at some lessons from that as those move along. They really just got rolling this year.
And I guess just a follow-up question to that. Are there states that are further along in those partnerships, or did this all happen kind of about the same time frame that they're all kind of at the same level of development?
Madam Chair and members, I am the grant itself was released at the same time. I think there may have been states, for instance, historically here in Minnesota, we have had Head Start, not early Head Start, the general Head Start, the 3 and 4-year-old partnering with child care. There used to actually be a stronger number of partners, I think, actually up in Representative Purcell's area with family child care, but it became, a lot of it is the funding. One of the key issues is that in order to be in that partnership, family child care providers have to take a much smaller number of children. So again, it's the economic issue. Can you afford to take 6 kids, even though you're getting reimbursed a little bit more? You have to do the math and make sure it works, and then still keep the quality as high as Head Start will look for. And so I think early on, without additional funding, it became difficult for those partners, but there's been a long history of at least trying to keep partners going. This was a new element that was funded specifically for early Head Start all around the country.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, I think that seems like a promising strategy to partner more, but I can see where concerns with grants not being ongoing and
sure.
How sustainable is it to embark on something like that if you don't know how long it's going to last or the grant is going to last. Are there any other questions members have at this time? Senator Sundjom.
Madam Chair, to that last slide, and mm-hmm. I'm going back and forth between your slides and some of the messages I got back home, and I think that last slide relates to potential solutions to cost and how Minnesota can respond. But one of the comments I received a lot of input on and conversation about was the cost and the burden of regulations and in some cases almost the fear of regulations. I don't see that mentioned at all in that last slide in terms of how can Minnesota respond.
Sure.
But it seems to me I heard back home that it's important that we think about responding to this regulation.
Sure.
Issue that please.
Madam Chair, Senator Sundjom, absolutely. I think, when we're looking, it's a difficult, no question that concerns about licensing and as Representative Franson was mentioning, a lot of it is also about transparency and consistency and access are huge. On the other hand, when we try to look at cost drivers and just when we look at the day-to-day costs of childcare, it doesn't tend to be a huge driver.
Okay.
So it's kind of a tricky one to put into quantifiable numbers. I guess I had the slide been able to go on and on.
Sure.
Certainly some, and knowing that this committee already was talking about looking at those issues, I guess I didn't think to put it on there, but from a purely cost driver, it's harder to quantify.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To that point, and Senator Sundjom point about cost drivers and regulation, I'll tell you one thing we heard in our travels around the state was regulations about infants. You can't pick them up, can't hold them. I mean, there's some things that just almost sound ridiculous in that regard with some regulations or how they're interpreted. So I just wanted to get that out there because
right.
There are some things that are going to drive costs.
And Senator Wicklund, Representative Purcell, I don't remember who's a representative, who's senator. Sorry, I think from a fear standpoint and a concern about assuaging fears, no question. I mean, if our question is, if we're doing a report or talking about how do we encourage more people to be in the field and how do we make sure that they are feeling like they can do their job, there are probably other factors that belong on these slides. Again, I was responding specifically to can I point to cost. So I appreciate what you're saying, and I hear you.
Senator Sundjom.
I'm sorry. I'm asking too many questions, but in any event, I'll just real quickly, to sort of put your presentation, a very good one, by the way, in context a little bit for myself. And I can remember the Child Care
Resource.
I think we funded it back to some extent with some CAP grant money from the federal government back in the city of Rochester. But how is your agency, and who do you represent here?
Sure.
Are you representing the providers? Or, what is your association? And,
sure.
And who funds your group?
Absolutely.
And it's not meant to be challenging, just to be informative.
That's Senator
McCulley.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, Senator Sundjom. So my role is coming to you as what we call the coordinating office of Child Care Aware, Child Care Resource and Referral. About 85% of our funding in my agency, I can't speak to the exact percentage in the 14 local agencies, so yes, there is one in Rochester,
right.
Which is now Families First, for example. About 85% of ours is federal money passed through the Department of Human Services.
Okay.
But who do we represent? Because of the work we do, I wish I had my slide with my Venn diagram. I think what we feel like is we do an awful lot of work with parents because we are the phone number and the website that people come to look for childcare. So we hear from the parent perspective. We do, of course, a lot of work with providers of training and grants. We have scholarships to help them go back to school called TEACH, grants to keep them staying in the field. And then, as I mentioned, a lot of community-based work, be it policy or we try to be at those tables with the initiative foundations in the rural areas, you name it, we try to be there. So we really feel like we represent or at least feel like we can come to the table with information from all of those sectors and try to work very hard to be in that neutral place.
Well, thank you, and that's helpful for me.
Representative Franson.
differences between states, how Minnesota ranks with regulations compared to other neighboring states?
Sure.
What's different? What's
sure.
the same?
Madam Chair and Representative Franson, another report our national office used to do was exactly that. It would take sort of the gold standard, if you will, of when it comes to things like regulation. Has, for those of you who don't know this, it's a little interesting. The Department of Defense, actually, historically, has had one of the strongest child care systems, well-funded, well-managed, training, well-compensated providers, et cetera. And so they would use that sort of gold standard and say, how do the different states, in a sense, match up? You know, in terms of regulations about health and safety, in terms of training. The last report that was done for family child care, I believe, was in 2012, and the last one for centers was 2013. I believe we ranked 17th in family child care and 6th in center-based care. What's interesting about that is they, in center-based care, they split it between what's on the books and then what can you actually go out and regulate. So we were really high on what was on the books, but because we didn't have as much funding for licensing or as many licensing visits, we dropped down on the ranking. The reason I say all this is, the reason we haven't done a report since then is, and I see that you have in your handouts, many of the changes that are now coming from the Child Care and Development Block Grant will wipe away a lot of that because a lot of it will be required. It will be interesting to see how some of the states, you know, I get this question a lot, how much is regulation broadly driving our cost in Minnesota? I can't ever point to a lot of specifics, but again, to the extent that regulations require things around ratios, that certainly, if you know, we've got 1-3 or 1-4, and you've got some states in the South in particular, I think, where the ratios are nothing we would want to see in terms of how many infants can be with an adult. Ratios isn't one of the things that's changing, but a lot of the training around health and safety, some of the pre-service training, I'm trying to think, a lot of the work around licensing, it's all going to be more uniform now. So where those changes existed before or differences with North Dakota, South Dakota, it probably won't be in another year.
Representative Franson.
And then the next one, thank you, Madam Chair. The next question has to do with costs with providers when they have to be away from the business due to training requirements and lack of availability in their area where they have to mm-hmm. travel somewhere else. So I'm just going to read a message from a Facebook post. This comes from Lake County. Okay. Lake County has very few providers, so I'm not going to name this provider's name because,
let me just start over here. So the question that I have is cost with providers and having to be away from their business due to training requirements, lack of availability in their area, so they have to travel elsewhere. So this question came from a provider in Lake County. Lake County does not have very many providers, and because of that and process of elimination, I will not release their name. This individual says that she's a licensed provider in her county that offers non-traditional hours. She has clients that come from as far as 45 miles away to get the care they need. Parent-aware rated. I guess I'm going to give it away. She's the only one in the home care provider in the county to pursue the rating. She's got some issues with how the program is being run currently. She sees it's kind of disorganized at the time. She can see why they have paid coaches to help them figure it out, but even the coaches are often confused. She had hoped all the wrinkles would be figured out prior to being offered in Lake County, but that has not happened. The program has little to do with the care that they offer and all to do with following directions and not giving up. So she got a rating a couple years ago. None of her parents who applied for the scholarship received one. She feels it's been a lot of time and expense with no relief for her parents. And then the training requirements for Parent Aware not aligned with the state requirements. So all that training in addition is to what is being required to do. So a suggestion was that taking SIDS yearly was maybe a waste of the time when she's been doing it for X many years and you're doing it every year, right? Every year. Do you really believe a 2-hour class on SIDS for the 21st time is productive in doing what it is intended to do? She's taken all the supervising classes. She wanted the information, and now every year she gets to retake those same classes over and over. She'll have over 200 hours of training that year, yet she will have to retake the SID and the AHT PT training, supervising for safety, most likely behavior development class, some of which she can now take online. Now, some of the training she's had to take were 60 miles away in Duluth. It required her shutting down her daycare, and she does the non-traditional care as well, so that really impacts families, right, especially in that region of the state. And driving the 120 miles on the dark, dangerous roads, if you've ever been up the North Shore during the nighttime, I used to live up in Silver Bay, so I know exactly Highway 61 there very well. The last training, she got home at midnight only to be up and ready to greet the kids at 5:30 in the morning. And it was a required class for parent to wear, but once again, having to travel, close down her business to do that. So do you have examples of these, like a breakdown of how much it actually costs that provider as well? Sure. I mean, we hear about the cost to parents when the providers have to shut down, but what about the cost to the providers when they have to shut down, sure, may not be able to get a sub because they also have to pay for those subs to get trained, right, just as if they were a licensed, right, provider as well?
Madam Chair and Representative Franson, that's a lot to unpack. Let me see if I can touch on a couple, and I'll see if my colleagues from the Department of Human Services may want to come up and touch on any of the others. A couple of examples. First of all, when you mentioned 2 years ago, we've come a long way, I would say, in terms of trying to, your point about aligning the training with what's required. I think we've come a lot further in 2 years than we had been at that point in terms of making things a little bit more aligned so that if you take a class here, it counts as both training as or licensing training as well as helping you with your parent aware score. You referenced online. We have worked very hard to make sure, and I know that online isn't everybody's cup of tea, but we have had online training through what's called Eager to Learn for years now, and we've made sure that we've added, so basically any course you need, particularly a course that you might need to help you with parent aware, is available online. So for those who do have to travel, don't want to travel or aren't able to travel or don't want to incur that cost, as you're pointing out, there's options to take that online. There is no question it is a challenge when we have 87 counties, some of which are extremely rural, and there may be only a couple of providers per however many miles. But in order to hold a training and have enough capacity and make sure that we're able to pay trainers and do all that, it becomes kind of a and we were back to arithmetic. I see that Jerry Kerber has joined me, so maybe I will hand it over to him to elaborate on some of the others.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Jerry Kerber. I'm from the Department of Human Services, and I'm the head of the Inspector General's Office, where we have the licensing division. And I thought I might just address the issue about the SIDS training in particular. The issue with some of this training that we found is and I think it was 2013 session, actually, there was a bill promoted by our agency that did increase the training requirements around sudden unexpected infant death. And it was in direct response to what we had been seeing as an increasing number of infant deaths in family child care, to the extent that they were getting to be in the vicinity of about 11 a year. And in as we looked at those deaths over a period of time, we could see that 75% of them were related, had an issue of a violation of safe sleep requirements. And some of that was directly related to the fact that, as some providers who had been in the business for a long time, maybe 21 years, they had training, some of the expectations for how you attend to an infant when the infant is sleeping have changed over the years. I mean, many people certainly started out with their own kids, and we heard this from a lot of providers that, you know, when they had their own children, the expectation was that they put the children on their stomach. And there were no restrictions on blankets. You give them all the fluffy, warm blankets that you want. Other times people were told they put their infants on their sides. And it was much later than that. It was in the 90s where suddenly, you know, the research was showing that really infants would best be sleeping on their backs with nothing else in the crib. And so the expectations for the providers changed pretty dramatically over time. And what we found when we were investigating many of those deaths is that the providers were really fully aware of what they were expected to do, but for one reason or another, they didn't follow those new requirements. They did it the way they had always done it, and the way they raised their own kids, and it was perfectly fine for their kids. And so, unfortunately, we saw deaths occurring to infants way too many times when perhaps they could have been prevented. And so what the intent was of this annual requirement was to keep the issue on more on a front burner and to keep reminding people about how important it is. We certainly have heard from many families who have lost infants, and it's just a tragedy. Unfortunately, in many of these cases, it happens in the first days of childcare, because the infant might be sleeping correctly at home, and then the infant is put down on its stomach, and it hasn't developed the neck muscles that maybe an infant would have had it been routinely been slept on its stomach. And so they're actually more vulnerable to those kinds of situations, and the tragic, you know, outcomes were just really dramatic. And so it was kind of in that vein that it was really our agency that proposed an increase in clarity of some of these training requirements regarding that, even if it is on an annual basis. And I think there is an option for every other year to be have it be video training, if I'm not mistaken. But we can, I think maybe in a future session that you have here, we can talk about what are all those training requirements in family child care and child care centers, and how are they the same, how are they different, and pre-service training versus in-service training.
Does that provide the information relevant
for? Yes, but I do just want to add a little sidebar regarding the comment about online training. What we found in different areas of the state when we went around was that Scandinavians and Norwegians don't like to do the online training because they like to get together and have coffee with one another and have some muffins and do the training together. So we found that very interesting.
Madam Chair, Representative Franson, I hadn't heard that particular demographic brought forward, but thank you. We do know that it is not for everyone. One thing I will quickly say, because I know you're also in areas where the access to internet can be difficult. We have always attempted to make it as user-friendly, low, dial-up, almost friendly, as well as having technical assistance. So we know a lot of providers, this is a whole new world, so we always have evening technical assistance available for childcare providers. So again, it may not be their preference, but at least we make it as user-friendly and accessible as we can, even if people have to bring their own muffins.
Any additional questions that members have for Ms. McCulley? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah. And I will reference there were three handouts that the Department of Human Services provided that provide some supplemental information. We didn't I didn't ask them to present this information, but I would like to make sure that you're aware that there's one handout, as I referenced earlier, about the licensing lessons learned from the select committee. There's another handout about key issues for the Department of Human Services, and you'll see those key areas highlighted in our work plan that we've developed, regulatory infrastructure, cost and affordability, workforce, and then the child care development block grant changes. And then the third handout is regarding the Child Care Development Block Grant reauthorization from 2014 when that was passed. There are a large number of changes that were made, and the department has highlighted what some of those reauthorization highlights are that will be impacting Minnesota. The department has put together a state plan to respond to the changes and how they're going to implement them. And we felt that there will be a number of areas that we'll cover in our meetings that that are impacted by this block grant reauthorization. And we'll bring those up as we discuss them. If you would like to have any further presentation just on the child care development block grant, we can do that, but we thought we'd incorporate the components that are apply to the different areas as we reach them. But this handout will give you kind of the high-level overview of that. If you have any other questions, though, for the department, there are several people from the Department of Human Services here who would be happy to answer any questions you have, or if there is an area that you feel like we need a full presentation about, we can certainly do that, ask them to do that. So I don't know if you had any other questions.
No.
Okay. Okay. Then we'll move on to, I'll just highlight with the work plan, this longer sheet of paper, Laura Larson has put this together, and we've on the first page listed the task force. Kind of the creation of the task force was related to these three charges: review the loss of child care providers, assess affordability issues, and identify areas that need to be addressed by the legislature. So we will be working on specific items to address those charges. And then the next two pages break down what the task force duties require. And the task force may, and then each of the bulleted items are from the statute, the duties from the statute. And when we looked at those duties, they seem to be relate to kind of four high-level areas. We broke it down that way. There's probably a lot of different ways we could do this, but it seemed like they fell into several categories. So Laura has made four high-level areas: regulatory infrastructure, workforce, training, and cost and affordability. And then we've divided the duties into those areas. And what we thought we could do is have one meeting on each of these topics to cover the duties that are included in there, and then be able to drill down and come up with some recommendations that would fall under these categories. So going forward, we'll identify when the next meeting is in September, and then hopefully have one meeting per month, September, October, November, and the last meeting in December. We would hopefully review, outline, and as much as we can of the report, have a report that will be delivered in January, and then you can give us feedback and we can have it completed by January 15th. Do you have any first thoughts or questions about this work plan? Does that seem like it will meet your needs? Do you have any questions about it right now?
Well, the important thing is that it meets the needs
of the providers and the parents.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Committee. Yes, definitely. Yes, I mean, what the desired outcome is that we are able to document specific recommendations that are going to be benefiting the providers and the parents and families. So, yes, that's definitely the key goal. Senator Johnson.
Not spend a lot of time on the regulation of child care. So if you would help me to understand, so the three charges is mm-hmm. what we will try to come up and address some recommendations to the legislature. And we'll use these topics to come up with.
Right.
The second,
correct.
I'm wondering if there's any possibility of if we could get some of the pertinent information maybe ahead of the meeting mm-hmm. a little bit.
Yep.
I think it would be helpful for me.
Yes, I'd be happy to do that. As we come up with a topic for the next meeting, we can certainly provide the handouts ahead of time to you.
Even
and yeah. To be able to review. Yeah, I'm happy to do that. Representative Purcell?
Madam Chair, and just following up on that, was the intent to go through these 1, 2, 3, 4? or 4321, or is there any reason? And I bring that up in following up on Senator Johnson about having information ahead of time, the regulatory infrastructure, if there is information that's developed there particularly, that we would want to see, you know. I think that it's going to make our work a little easier for sure when we get here.
Right.
So.
Yes, I can see your point. I don't think we had these in a particular order. I don't know, Laura, did you? Okay, so we can arrange the meetings in any order, but I think your point of having enough information up front to come to the meeting with, you know, the ability to discuss the topic, yes, definitely we would want to do that. And Representative Purcell.
Madam Chair, I would almost believe that if we looked at that regulatory infrastructure first, that may set the stage for some of the following
sure.
categories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. Okay. Any other questions or comments about the work plan? And Senator Sungin.
Madam Chair, I think the plan is fine. I just, it's like, how do we figure that, you know, we wouldn't be here if the system, whatever that system is, would have figured out charges 1, 2, and 3. So I'm believing they're fairly thorny, complicated issues that are the answers to which are probably in this audience out here to some extent. So how do we sitting 30 feet apart or 40 feet apart come together and get that dialogue from the people that really probably know the answers? I mean, I'll tell you what, I don't, but we're charged to come up with them. And so I'm not pontificating just to suggest that I understand what the process is going to be, but it seems to me that we're going to have to have a communicative process here, a conversation, if you will, with people that really understand that, and probably almost in a less formal kind of setting than we have here.
Yes, well, definitely we want to seek feedback yeah. on the topics before coming to the meeting so we can have more discussion. I guess I'd be open to, I don't know, other ways to really structure the meetings themselves other than...
Madam Chair, I don't either.
But,
I just
but I know definitely what you mean, that we do need to have the opportunity for providers and agencies be able to have the topic ahead of time so they can come and provide us the input. We're planning to devote a significant part of each meeting to a public testimony period, which we'll move to next. And so if we will publicize the topic far enough in advance so that hopefully then that will allow people to bring their specific comments related to that topic to the meeting. And then hopefully we can synthesize that as a group. So, yeah. It is going to be challenging, though, because I think there is, you know, a large amount of material to cover, some really large issues, and I think we'll do what we can to come up with some tangible recommendations. So, Senator Johnson.
I'm trying to remember this myself. I'm on the commission, Legislative Commission on Surrogacy, and we had a meeting today. And part of it kind of fits in with what I'm thinking about this legislative commission. And I'm asking people, when you're the experts, we're the people that listen and hope that we can come up with something that works. But I feel like I need some recommendations regarding charge 1, charge 2, and charge 3, just even if it's not right. It's not necessarily what that you might happen, but there is something out there that I can, especially myself, as I'm speaking about someone who needs more information maybe than others here. So if you can offer suggestions about how to review why are we losing child care providers in the state, and what might we be able to do to make something happen better? real specific. Mm-hmm. Because we are so short on time, and yet we feel like this is, we have more time than we have in a legislative session. And that's why we're doing this. So
mm-hmm. Right.
If you can follow me and understand what I'm saying for myself.
Yeah. No, I
thank you.
I think that's very helpful. And our member information is listed on the website. If people do have supplementary information, please feel free to email it to myself or Representative Franson, and we will definitely make sure that the whole committee or task force receives it if you don't send it to all of us. But, yes, we will definitely try to take as much input as we can. I would like to move to the public testimony part. We do have a number of people who signed up to provide some testimony. And I would say, since there are nine people, so I would say if you could limit your comments to about 3 minutes, and then we'll see if we can fit in everybody before 8 o'clock. The first person signed up is Heidi Hagel Braid, and I believe that we have a handout. Do we have, or is it distributed or not? Oh, okay.
Splurge for the color pop.
And Heidi is from First Children's Finance, and we do have a handout that you provided to Laura Larson, and thank you for doing that. And you can go ahead.
Okay. Good evening. Thank you for the opportunity to provide some information about business issues impacting family child care, particularly in Greater Minnesota. My name is Heidi Hagel Braid, and I'm a regional director at First Children's Finance. We are a national nonprofit organization that's headquartered here in Minnesota, and we help children, families, and communities thrive by increasing the availability, affordability, and quality of early care and education. We work on the business side of childcare, ensuring that childcare businesses remain stable and sustainable. What I've given you a copy of tonight is a data brief that we are just about ready to publish. So you're getting a little bit of a sneak peek here. And given that you have the charge of examining the affordability of childcare, I think this document will be helpful in providing insight into family childcare business performance data and how policies and decisions made at your level play out in family childcare businesses across the state. So the data brief is dense. I'm just going to give you some highlights, and you have it, and you can find me later if you have additional questions. This data was aggregated from a tool that we built specifically for the business analysis of family child care because very little research has been done on the practices and which factors most impact their profitability. Understanding the drivers of success is really important for family child care providers and for policymakers, and our tool was built on for multiple uses. It should be used by providers to analyze their business and also to aggregate that data and study the impacts and trends that we see in performance data. In the data, you're going to see the aggregate result of 43 child care providers in Minnesota. All of the tools inside of that data set were completed in the context of a business leadership cohort conducted by First Children's Finance. And we studied 140 core data elements, and so we've given you just the highlights here. 28% of the providers were inside of the Twin Cities metro area, and the remaining sample were from 15 counties across Greater Minnesota. On average, providers have been in business for 12 years. They work primarily alone, and on average, they serve 10 children. When we look at their revenue, they report about a $50,000 profit, about $51,000 if you round up. 90% of that comes from tuition. And 30% of the providers in the sample received child care assistance payments. And of those, the payments accounted for 23% of the tuition received. 5% of those providers also received income from an early learning scholarship. When we start to look, though, at revenue, one of the important things to keep in mind is that preschool tuition payments make up about 54% of all tuition income, and that's a really important factor to think about as we are exploring all kinds of different universal and voluntary pre-K things across the state, and a mixed delivery system is really important. You'll also see a breakout of family child care expenses, and on average, providers reported annual expenses of about $26,000. Two-thirds of those expenses are related to occupancy, and you can see a breakdown there of all of the other pieces that make up the puzzle of those expenses. When we look at annual revenue and expenses, on average, the profit of a family child care business or their take-home pay is about $24,566. The providers in the sample report that they're working about 53 hours per week. Their family child care business is actually operating that many hours, but that does not include an additional 12 hours a week to clean, to manage, to prepare, to shop, to create lesson plans, any of those things. So when we convert that to an hourly wage, 49% of the family child care providers in the sample are making less than $8 per hour before taxes. You can see in a graphic that you'll see the spread of what profit and pay looks like. You can see there's a large range there, but when you look at that 49% of people making under $8 per hour, that's a very important factor. The other thing that I'd like to point out to you in my time remaining is that when we compare Metro to Greater Minnesota, there are a couple of things to note. Metro programs are making about $9,000 more annually than programs in Greater Minnesota. Their program expenses are not significant. They are very much the same, only about a $1,200 difference between the two geographies. However, differences in profit are driven almost entirely by differences in tuition rates. And Greater Minnesota providers report serving more children on average than providers in the metro. So that means that they're fully enrolled. They're maximizing every slot, every hour. They're serving more kids in their program, and they're making less money. And I think that this finding lends viability to the idea that child care assistant rates should be aligned with operating expenses rather than the tuition rates determined by the market, especially in rural Minnesota. There are lots of other things inside of here. It's a very dense data brief, but I would be happy to answer questions about it or to come back at a later time to give you further insight. Thanks for the opportunity to share this information, and please reach out if I can be of assistance. Absolutely. Thank you.
Next, I have Desiree Rotter. I hope I didn't mispronounce your name too poorly. Thank you for coming tonight, and please just introduce yourself for the record.
Hello. My name is Desiree Rotter. I'm a licensed provider in Washington County. I've been running my business since 1984. This has been a very difficult 10 years of change, seeing a lot of things come and go. So since you've covered a lot of things, one of the things I will share is that I had the opportunity over a year and a half ago to start calling providers throughout our state. I reached out from everyone from up north in the Iron Range to central Minnesota to the metro area, southeast and southwest Minnesota, and asked lots of different questions. And it seems like a lot of the same things are being said. With that being said, I would like to say that Minnesota needs to be a leader again. This is not just our state's issue, but it's also a national issue. With every change that has been made over the past 10 years, we are witnessing the effects. In 2004, we had over 14,000 licensed providers, and we are under 9,300. What is going on is hurting all that are involved. Families are desperate. Providers are drained. This is a business issue, not a political one. Child care providers need to be included at state-level stakeholder meetings that impact us. They need a democratic process for representation. Providers of family child care are ultimately the ones responsible for their business. What is currently in place is not working. No one cares more about these issues than us, the caregiver, the provider. Thank you.
Cynthia Cunningham, a child provider here in St. Paul in Ramsey County. Same occurs as I live 2 miles from the Capitol, so I show up frequently. Madam Chair, committee members, I worked on a lot of legislative issues. I worked with DHS. I worked with my county. I've sat before many of you many times. And I have felt consistently respected and listened to and worked with on all accounts. My wish and hope is that every licensed provider in the state of Minnesota would have that same experience, because I think they would all feel differently to what our process is in our licensing. Listening to Ms. McCauley talk about the percentage of centers versus family child care is exactly why this discussion really needs to hone in on family child care and the loss. Sometimes it's hard to figure out why so much of focus would be of that discussion, but those numbers speak volumes, and the affordable care for all families is in family child care much more than in centers. Many family child care providers feel that with the regulations, with the implementations, with the structures of training and everything else, there's almost a push that I call it an unintended consequence, will be that there will be more a need for, a drive for more centers because we do not have family child care. And that is, I do not believe, a good serving for parents or for our state. My perspective is, last year I received 5 correction orders, but from a relatively new licensor in my county here in Ramsey County. Prior to that, had started a push in Ramsey County because of the inconsistencies of the licensors. I was privileged to work directly with DHS and our county to essentially really change what was happening in Ramsey County. 4 of the 5 were overturned because I knew the law better than the licensor did. And that's a lot of the frustration, is that the licensors are implementing the rules, the laws, as they see fit, as they have been told by DHS, or as they're having to make up conclusions. I really do believe that everyone's doing the best they can with what they know and what they've got and what they're put forth to do, but it's not happening. I akin our licensing process to driving down a road. There's no speed limit sign. Police officer pulls me over, gives me a ticket, and then puts up the speed limit sign. We often don't know what the direction is or what the speed limit is. To me, there's a disconnect in the system, not in the people, of DHS, the counties, and the providers. DHS puts out the licensing to the 87 counties, and the 87 counties implement it. The only time DHS really knows whether or not the licensor is giving correct interpretation is if I get a correction order and then I ask for a reconsideration. That shouldn't be the litmus test about whether our licensors know what they're doing or not. So DHS knew nothing of my correction orders or of what the licensor was doing or saying or expecting of me until I asked for a reconsideration. Not all providers are built like me, nor should they be. We'd probably all be better off. But we shouldn't have to push back that hard to know our rules and say, no, that's wrong. By the time I got my reconsideration settled, it took almost 10 months. I'm supposed to have the paperwork on my wall for 2 years. Well, I almost had a year gone before I got it corrected that I was right and that the licensor wasn't. So that would be an example of really how frustrating it is for us. I think that the staff at DHS has a very clear perspective of what we should be doing. I think there's, again, a disconnect when it goes from DHS to the counties and then how it gets to us. If that would be corrected and fixed, I think that would help a lot. When I hear of a provider, my skin crawls. When I have a provider who thinks that we have to do the SIDS training for 2 hours every 2 years, I sat and worked with Jerry Gerber in the DHS to make that so that the video was available and that we could use that instead of doing it, that there is still a provider that thinks we have to do two-hour in-person training is the disconnect of communication. So that's a huge piece of it. I worked for over a year to try to get clarification on the poisonous plants and how it impacts providers. Providers were being told and given correction orders for having tomato plants, as an example. There was a grant that was being told by Hennepin County that we could not have, don't put tomato plants in the grant because you can't have tomato plants. DHS was telling me, yes, you can have tomato plants. I don't know why. I don't want to be in the middle of that conversation. I end up in it and I take it. And fortunately, DHS has now come out with a clarification and a guideline on poisonous plants, including that, yes, we can have tomato plants. The problem is that is now posted on DHS website, which is lovely, except the only providers that know that it is there are the ones who know me or other providers who have worked with me or the few counties who have disseminated the information to their providers. Ramsey County has told me recently they thought DHS communicated all of this information to us. I'm like, no. No, they don't. We've been told by DHS that the funding, the process of communication with providers is not there to give us all of that information. That right there is one of my big ones, is that I think that everything in licensing, the statewide, I understand that there's differences in specific counties, but if there is information, guidelines and such that is given out to every licensor in the state of Minnesota, every provider in the state of Minnesota should get that same guidance and that same direction so we know what we're functioning with. I always start out with a nice print and a lot of scribbles end up on it. So I think DHS communicating directly with providers. There was an implementation in funding in 2013 for an Ask the Licensor in DHS that was implemented in January of this year. I have found it potentially good, but very frustrating. I and other providers are not getting what I would consider good, accurate, consistent information. We were told it was so that if we got the DHS's information, then we would all be on the same clarification. That's not happening. Often whoever is staffing the DHS online is going to the county and asking the county what they are doing, and then that's the answer to the provider. We already know that problem. We need to know what DHS says is the rules on particular issues that we have questions for. And then if the county needs worked with, we can handle that. But we need to know what DHS expects of us. I would really like to see the liaison type staff position to be there. And I put it in akin, I've testified before, that it be like a school liaison where that person does not report to DHS, because otherwise we're going to get really messy on alliances and process. But that would be a person. The manual's an awesome intent, and I hope that gets done quickly. So essentially that whole roadmap about how we're doing communication, I always have a whole list. As far as Parent Aware, I've participated in Parent Aware. I would say Parent Aware needs realigned with and listen strongly to what family child care is. Again, if we have a small percentage of places that are centers and a large percentage that are family, we should be it should be obvious that family child care is. I was not given my second star because I was one of the things we have to do is a daily schedule, not the curriculum that we're giving to the children, but how our day looks. And I was supposed to have one schedule for infant toddlers and one for preschool and preschoolers. My kiddos walk around throughout the whole day. We're in the same place. We're in the same routine. We're in the same process. There's no difference. That's a center view, not a family child care view. I think that the policy making needs to be looked, like with the rates and things, everybody needs to be really clear. That's based on centers. If a large percentage and the most affordable child care that we have in this state is family child care, then a lot of the rhetoric, a lot of the policy, a lot of the process needs to be put to that perspective in funding, not specifically on the small, as the given small number of centers that are available. I think given that number, I guess the one thing I said, that was kind of, I knew it, but hearing it again here today, and I'm taking more than my 3 minutes, so I apologize, makes me think that when I hear DHS say that they can't communicate us because the funding's not there and that the counties are holding the burden of the cost for licensing us, the state doesn't. Every county holds that burden. We pay our costs to the counties. If the DHS, I'm going to be a little, I think DHS's budget needs to be looked at to see where that money is going. If they can't give me an email or a letter and all the cost is going on the county, I think there might need to be some realignment between where their resources are going to centers versus family child care. I've heard the Department of Defense, I would caution, I have two children in the military. I've been living the military life for the last 5 years. I've been on bases. I have talked to providers, both seen the centers, talked to providers at the national conference about the Department of Defense process. It's a lovely process. It's a lovely thing. But I know I wouldn't want to live to my son's standard of living when they're in the military. I don't know that that truly should be the standard that we're aiming for our children in our homes on our daily basis. So I would put a caution of how we look at what those standards are on that part. So I appreciate your time, and thank you very much.
Next person on that, Claire Sanford.
Good evening. Thank you. I'm sorry. I'm Claire Sanford from and I'm representing the Minnesota Child Care Association, which is an association of about 250 child care centers across the state of Minnesota. I'm also an employee of New Horizon Academy, which is a large provider in Minnesota. Thank you, Chair Halverson-Wickland, and all the members for giving us something to do tonight other than the state fair. Can you hear? Is this okay? Is that any better? Okay. I'm sorry?
I don't know if there's a button to check that. Is it on? I think they're on. They're
just on. Is this better?
Yeah, that one actually is.
Do I need to start over?
No, it's okay. You can.
Okay. Technology. Well, I'm going to add our voice to the chorus of people in support of the child care and development fund reauthorization, which I know you've talked about today and have information in front of you about, and what that means for the Child Care Assistance Program, or CCAP, in Minnesota. Because if we're serious about affordability and supply that meets the demand, we must reform CCAP, which suffered massive cuts on the state level in 2003 and hasn't recovered. Child care assistance in Minnesota, I'm sorry this is a broken record, those of you who are on the Select Committee heard some of this already, child care assistance in our state is hard to get. We have waiting lists. It's hard to use. We have very low rates, which limits where families can use their child care assistance. And it's hard to keep because of administrative hurdles that work against families. As Rep. Purcell mentioned, the heartbreaking story of a family who moves counties and loses child care just because of that, even though they've done everything else correctly. So much of CCAP is governed by the Federal Child Care and Development Block Grant, was reauthorized in 2014, major federal overhaul, and is now law. And thanks to the reauthorization, CCAP is no longer just a work support and a place to park kids while families go and do what they need to do. It's an investment in school readiness and in child development. And in 2016, Minnesota DHS brought forth a very comprehensive proposal that would have brought us into substantial compliance with this, including raising CCAP reimbursement rates. And unfortunately, it did not get through the legislature last year. But I want to recognize, talk about public service. A lot of our friends here from DHS, a lot of work lies ahead for them in this reauthorization. And they have been excellent at engaging stakeholders from across the state of Minnesota in that process. There are two main parts to the reauthorization. I'll put it into buckets of reforms and rates. They address the hard-to-use and hard-to-keep pieces of CCAP. The reforms are aimed at both quality and family stability, and you have a breakdown in front of you of some of those things, things like 12-month authorizations for families, not having your copay jump more than the cost of the raise you just got, or not losing your child care if you switch counties. And unfortunately, Minnesota is now out of compliance with much of the law. In fact, only three states in the nation requested more waivers for pieces of that law than Minnesota. Guess who didn't request any waivers? States like Mississippi, Louisiana, Arkansas. These are not usually the states Minnesota compares itself to on issues like this. And Massachusetts didn't request any waivers either. And I got to say, I used to live and work in Massachusetts, and people in Massachusetts would always look at the rankings and whine about Minnesota being at the top and Massachusetts just below. But they're probably pretty happy about this when they saw that they're at the top on this one. So that's just upsetting to all of us. How are we letting this happen in Minnesota? We're not even meeting minimum federal requirements, and Minnesota is known for being better than this, especially when children and families are involved. Rates are another huge part of the reauthorization. The federal government recently sent a letter to the Minnesota Department of Human Services, and I've brought copies for all the members of the committee. And this letter was to, was to the commissioner of DHS and said it was granting only conditional approval of Minnesota's plan to operate the CCAT program because it noted that many of these federal requirements have not yet been met. And the letter is especially clear on adequate reimbursement rates for CCAP, which we've heard a fair amount about tonight. And I'll just paraphrase the main quote from the letter. The letter basically says, hey, Minnesota, we, the federal government, are not convinced that your reimbursement rates are high enough to let low-income families play at the same level that middle and high-income families get to play in terms of what they're able to access for their children and their families. So it's kind of putting Minnesota on notice that we've got to do something about these reimbursement rates. Reimbursement rates that are too low hold down supply, they keep down staff wages, they force some providers not to accept families using CCAP or to limit the number of families that use CCAP. Parents can be asked to pay large differences between CCAP reimbursement rates and whatever the tuition rate is, and that has a disastrous impact on families. Just in the company I work for, New Horizon Academy, it's a large child care center provider, serves about 8,000 children at a given time. In the last year alone, we've seen a 15% decrease in the number of families using CCAP that are in our programs. And I don't say that to say, woe is us, we lost 15% of our business, because that's not the case. We're fine. Most of those slots have been filled by private pay families who have higher incomes and are able to pay the tuition. We're doing fine, but that 15% of those families that we lost, we don't know if they're doing fine. So that is a huge concern to us. And finally,
if you can summarize it.
In summary, we have meaningful federal reforms, rates and reforms as part of the CCDF package, but we're not in compliance with most of them yet. And we, our overall goal is to fund a system, as I'm sure it is for you, where families have access to their choice of early education providers and providers have the necessary resources to provide quality services. And we urge you to keep CCAP and these federal reforms top of mind. We also support the governor's child care tax credit expansion because, as we saw with Ms. McCulley's presentation, it's not just low-income families that struggle, it's middle-income families as well. So thank you very much for listening, and I'll let the next person come up.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Let's see. A couple of people on here say no, that they're not testifying. So the next one I'm not sure of. Do you know the last? There's our Allie Zome or no? Okay, you didn't. I wasn't sure. And then the last one I have Holly Seville. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Holly Saville, and I'm a licensed family child care provider in St. Michael. As you probably know, that's in Wright County, so I'm not exactly Greater Minnesota, and I'm not exactly Metro. So I know there's been concern in the past that in your tours of the state that you were only focusing on Greater Minnesota, so perhaps I can give you a little better perspective. We'll reiterate some of the other concerns that others have shared, but one huge issue is that most of you probably are not aware of is that in our state, family child care providers are told that if my husband wanted to hold a new baby, like our own child, that he would have to take SUIDS and abusive head trauma training, and technically, because he'd be providing care for more than 30 different days, he would also have to take 16 hours of training and he has to be background checked because he lives in my home. But that was not the intent of the rule. It was never the rule when I was originally licensed 11 years ago. But that is the interpretation. For a husband to hold his own child, for a grandparent to visit from out of state to hold their grandchild, for a sibling to hold his brother or sister, they have to have these trainings. Now, what kind of interpretation is that? How many family child care providers would you have right now in the state if they knew that was the law, if that was going to be the interpretation when it came into play? Now, I'm all for keeping children safe, but I just wanted you to be aware that that is directly one of the issues that is contributing to the shortage of family child care providers in the state. Now, people should be able to, if we're talking, and these are not the licensed providers either. The licensed providers do need those trainings. Another issue that has come up in several counties, I know Jackson County was doing it up until a year ago. Anoka County is supposedly still doing this, telling providers that they have to follow licensing rules 24/7, even if they are not a 24/7 child care. I know many friends in different counties, Anoka County too, who for their own child's birthday party on a Saturday when their family child care is closed are having to book outside facilities for all their family members because their licensor is telling them that they cannot have that because you can only have, let's say, a C2 license like me. I can only have 2 under the age of 2, and I can only have 10 under school age, that's age 5, and I can only have up to 12. Well, I don't know how about you, but I'm sure if you have any kind of family get-together whatsoever, that you probably have more than 12 children in your home. And so these family child care providers have that burden too. So I want you to be aware of that. Now, these issues are, this type of environment that we've been subjected to, especially in the past 5 years, is directly contributing to that child care shortage, which also increases the cost. We want to follow those rules, but they keep changing on us. You can't even keep up. And probably more than other people in the state, I know most of those rules by heart, all 26 pages of Rule 2, and there's probably about 88 pages between Chapter 245A, Chapter 245C, 668. I know them, but it's very hard to keep up with these interpretations. It seems like they go through the rules randomly each month, take a section that they're going to update the interpretation on, and then providers don't even hear about it until someone gets a correction order in the state, and then someone talks about it on Facebook, and then providers are saying, whoa, wait, that's not the rule. Look, this is what the statute says. How can they be interpreting it that way? When DHS tries to change the rules, in spite of legislative intent, there should be accountability. The rules need to be tightened. There needs to be an outside entity when we challenge DHS on correction orders. If you're issued a fine from DHS, you appeal to DHS, the same entity that gave you the fine. That's not fair. Administrative law judges have many times told DHS that they have abused their power, haven't conducted thorough investigations, etc. And this does not speak to any of the individuals at DHS because I've worked really well with them in the past. It's just the system itself needs to be fixed. A good example is their interpretation of tracking attendance for CCAP, and they extended that despite independent house research telling them that this was not the intent of the law. They extended it to say that if you're on the food program, you have to track every child's attendance during the day. Even though we already have that in our food program, we already have to track meal attendance, which is more specific than sign in and sign out at the beginning and end of the day. Thankfully, providers advocated to get rid of that interpretation in law last year, or 2 years ago.
training for county licensors is a huge issue, the inconsistency in licensing. In 2013, DHS was allowed two FTEs to specifically address training for licensors about licensing inconsistency. I want to know where that money went, and what are those what are the names of those two full-time employees, and what are those two full-time employees doing right now? Because that was specifically to address these licensing inconsistencies, which I guarantee that is the number one reason why family child care providers are leaving the business. If you are on Facebook and any provider group, you will cry your heart out. To every day, we are losing providers. We lose more than one provider every single day. The thing is that DHS can put providers out of business with no due process. They can be put out of their homes. I know providers who now can't make their mortgage because it might take 9 months to get an erroneous correction order overturned or a negative action overturned. And then it took 3 years to get these facts and questions on the DHS website. If you have a question or concern, it goes directly to your licensor from the DHS website. It should be able to be answered by DHS, and DHS gives the licensor direction. We need an audit of the DHS licensing division to find out where these resources are going and if they need to be, reallocated. I do want to ask for caution about increasing the subsidy rate, not that it might not need to be increased, but throwing more money at a program that it's broken and it needs to be fixed. I really think that we need to fix the program, make it run more smoothly, be more fair, perhaps get rid of the waiting list altogether before we throw more money at it, because I fear that money might not go to the people who need it the most. I also support having a family child care liaison. I know that was in one of the bills this session, but it did not pass, but I strongly support that. In the update from licensing, we've been told that there's going to be 400 questions on those iPads that licensors are going to be carrying into our homes. And we've asked for those questions on several occasions, and we have yet to see them. But if we're adding more licensors because they have to now do annual inspections to meet that child care development block grant requirement, I'm curious how those licensors are going to be able to get through our homes with 400 questions, and how are providers going to be able to care for children if your licensor is there for, 400 questions? I'd assume it would take a few hours. So I really do thank the task force for taking the time to listen to our concerns, and I really appreciate that. And I know there's a lot more issues, and I'm excited for you to hear from other providers. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Those are all the names that I have on the list to testify. Is there anyone else who didn't sign up who wishes to testify in the public comment period? So seeing none, Representative Franson.
Thank you. Say, I have a question regarding the child care block development grant. I do know that there was a bill brought forward last session to fully fund CCAP was $500 million. I am wondering how much is it going to cost to fully implement the child care block grant? What is DHS proposing? Just so that we have something that we are looking forward to or not looking forward to. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Yeah, that's a good question, because I think they did bring forward a full proposal, and if we can get either a reference to that, where it was brought forward and in a bill form, maybe that would be helpful, or through documentation you provided last year. Mr. Koppel, go ahead and introduce yourself, and then you can answer the question.
Okay. Thank you. Members, I'm Jim Koppel. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services. So we did bring forward, there were a number of proposals last year that were considered increasing rates for providers to the 50th percentile, funding a number of fully funding the waiting list, as well as the reauthorization conformity. The reauthorization piece of that is about $50 million to conform with those federal requirements. and that does not include an update on what the reauthorization requires us to do is not change the we're at roughly, the 25th percentile for rates right now. It basically says we need to do a more current survey. So that will also cause an increase in rates, but it will stay at the 25th percentile, but it will be a more recent market survey. So if you add those together, I'm not sure I can get you the full number, but, it's much less than that $200 million or half a billion dollar number that included all those proposals. Is that clear?
I think it was clear. Is there a way, is there documentation that you supplied during session that we could just have access to, or could you point us to?
In terms of a further
breakdown of the cost, for the reauthorization?
Absolutely, Madam Chair. There's pieces. There's continuous eligibility for 12 months. There's a cost to that. There's annual licensure. There's a cost to that. Each of these pieces that are new requirements have a cost to them, and we do have that broken out into categories. So we could break that big number down into a smaller number.
Yeah, I think if you can provide that by email to us, before, just as supplemental information, I think that will help us as we go forward. And when we refer to things that are required, federal requirements, here's something we're planning to implement, or, just having that frame of reference of what the breakdown of costs are, I think that would be helpful.
Right.
Senator Johnson.
Was. Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, yes, it was. It was all part of the Health and Human Services legislation, part of the governor's. It was part of the governor's budget, but it also included other initiatives as well. Funding the waiting list, increasing rates. So there were other elements involved, but this was part of that package.
Okay. Does that answer?
And then one more question.
Go ahead, Representative Franson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner Koppel, so there was a question brought up about the two FTEs regarding the training of the licensors. And Mayor, maybe this is a better question for Mr. Kerber. But that issue was brought up in my office about those two FTEs, because I wanted to transition those two FTEs into one of the bill ideas that I had. And the comment that was made is that those FTEs went to cost of living increases for people within DHS. So do you want to just elaborate a little bit on that? Because, the training of the licensors is kind of a big deal to the providers.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Koppel.
Madam Chair, Jerry Kerber, from the Department of Human Services again. To answer your question, Representative Franson, I don't know specifically to those two positions. I can get that information and get back to you. There are issues regarding how cost of living increases for employees get covered when it's not included in any automatic budget increase. If there's a negotiated increase of 2.5% per year, that 2.5% comes from somewhere. And so typically what has to happen then, if there's not an increase in an appropriation, there's a decrease in FTEs to cover that cost. I don't know that that's what happened in this case. Specifically, we do have a resource, one FTE that's committed to county training. And it's not adequate. It's certainly not adequate. I think in your bill last year, you had, you addressed some county oversight, and certainly the block grant requirements are a game changer for us in that we need to install a whole new system of oversight with counties. you know, counties are our partners in this licensing relationship in that they have certain delegated authority and responsibility under the statute. And, you know, there's 100 or so county licensors in 87 counties and 9,000 child care providers. And, you know, we're doing our best to make sure that there's a consistent message given to counties. But there is drift from time to time, and we're aware of that. And under our proposal that I hope you'll see in the governor's budget, you know, we're seeking to address that by having much more significant oversight of that partnership we have with counties, where we will actually be doing some monitoring of county activity on site by our agency. Instead of right now, the way we're funded is we monitor a county every 4 years. We go in and see how they've been doing licensing activities. That's how we do the ongoing oversight. On a regular basis, however, of course, counties are making recommendations to our office on licensing sanctions, and then we assure that there's some consistency on how sanctions are issued statewide. But as was reported earlier, I think, by Ms. Cunningham, we are not aware of all of the day-to-day interactions that counties are having with providers and issuing correction orders until we hear about it from a provider and we hear about it through their request for reconsideration of an action, or increasingly through our website. You heard a little bit about it, and you know, we started this new system where any license holder can ask a question of, you know, what's the department's interpretation of this rule part. And the reason that we send that out to the counties, we want to find out what the county did tell them, so that it's sort of more or less a teachable moment. We want to know as much as possible what counties are telling providers. And so then when we determine what the department's official interpretation is, we go back to the county and we say, you know, what you said to them is not what we want you to say to them. And then that is forming the basis of our training that we're providing for counties throughout the state. It's not enough, and we get that. And so hopefully we're going to be addressing that through our proposal this year.
Thank you. Representative Franson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just one more thing, Mr. Kerber. A while ago, I had asked for the questions on what would be asked on that iPad, and you said you would get those to me. So I assume you're still compiling what those questions would be that would be asked at the home during a licensing visit.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Franson, and I'm sorry if I didn't get back to you on that. So what's being referred to here is one of the efforts we have to increase consistency is and actually ultimately hopefully to make county licensors a little bit more efficient is an electronic process where we're making this program available where they can use an iPad or a laptop or even a phone to run this application where they'll go through the checklist for that reflects the requirements in the rule and in some of those other statutes that I think Ms. Cunningham mentioned again too. So it's the aggregate list of all of the requirements. Not all of those requirements apply to every setting. And so if a provider doesn't care for infants, they're not looking at the infant requirements, for instance. And so that's what we're going to be doing. There aren't new requirements in there, but it requires the provider or the licensor to at least verify compliance or noncompliance. One of the things that we're going to be encountering is that when we get increased consistency, it might not always be in the direction that people want. The increased consistency we're interested in is enforcement of the rules. Sometimes what we've heard is that there are county licensors who haven't been as serious about enforcing every part of the rule. And so we're going to be encountering that issue. And so we're going to be seeing where county licensors who in the past maybe had a much more informal relationship with the license holder, that might change a little bit. And so we'll be having to deal with that. But it's all in the name of getting some increased consistency. And then that program will actually print out the correction order letter, we're hoping, that will be available for posting. A federal requirement is that we have to make some of this, we have to make much more information available on a very accessible website. And so we're trying to meet a number of different different goals with some with as much technology as we can. But I will get you those questions.
Any further questions? Members? Okay, thank you very much for providing the information. I don't think we have any more questions tonight. And any other comments? If not, we'll close the meeting. And I had sent our, I think Nathan had sent out some dates for September and October meetings. And I've heard back from some of you. And so once we get that, we'll set our September meeting date. And then the gavel will be with Representative Franson for that meeting. So thank you again for coming tonight. I really appreciate all your time and putting the time into this. And I hope that you'll provide us some feedback on issues if we missed anything and specific guidance that you'd like us to take a look at. So thank you again. The meeting is adjourned.